Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Robert Koenigsberg, SleepQuest CEO, and William C. DeMint, MD, PhD, a world-renowned sleep expert. Robert Koenigsberg suffers from sleep apnea and understands the physical and emotional hardship this disease can cause. When he founded SleepQuest 23 years ago, the medical field lacked universal standards of care for sleep disorders. Sleep laboratories and treatment through home care were often disjointed and uncomfortable. The disjointed process is still predominant method that is done today. Mr. Koenigsberg wanted to demonstrate a more effective, individualized method of integrated sleep apnea diagnosis and treatment that would put patients' health and comfort first. William C. DeMint is the world's leading authority on sleep, sleep deprivation, and the diagnosis and treatment of sleep disorders. In 1963, DeMint joined the psychiatry department at Stanford University, where for the past 35 years, he has continued his studies on the neurochemistry of sleep and the functional significance of the different sleep states. In 1970, Dr. DeMint founded the world's first sleep laboratory at Stanford University, which introduced all-night polysomnographic PSG examination of patients. Dr. DeMint is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine and the division chief of the Stanford University Division of Sleep. Dr. DeMint is a premier sleep scientist who works as advisor to the San Francisco Bay Area-based SleepQuest office. It's all yours.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's wonderful to see you all here. Thank you for coming. And I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for having us. I'd like to ask a favor of all of you, and that is if you can give a living legend a round of applause, we may be able to get him to sit right here because he is actually the first 15, 20 minutes of my talk is about him. And so having him sit there is not right. So if you could do that. Thanks. Appreciate that. All right. Now time for my cards so I remember everything. All right. So we did that. I'm a graduate of Cal Berkeley where I studied, all you Go Bears. So, I have a degree in economics. I don't have an MBA. I think I've earned an MBA off the seat of my pants during the past 23 years at SleepQuest. It's been a very interesting ride. I've enjoyed immensely the group of people that I've put together to run the organization with me and all of our employees and ex-employees. Some of them are here tonight. I have, as Bill was saying, I have sleep apnea. I have an interesting type of sleep apnea. I have what's called complex sleep apnea, which means the brain tells the diaphragm to stop breathing during my sleep. So it's not just obstructive, but it's also the brain telling the diaphragm to stop breathing. So I need a special kind of device that will kick a breath in every once in a while and when I need it. And I met another gentleman who also suffers from the same malady, and everyone is different when it comes to sleep. Everybody has a different way of sleeping. There is no perfect way. And I'm getting off topic. So, Dr. Dement, I would consider him to be, as I said, a living legend. You guys are really fortunate to be here with him tonight. Back in 1970, think about it, it was, 37 years ago. And in 1970, sleep is an unconscious activity. And therefore, cardiovascular medicine, diabetes, pulmonary medicine, they all existed. But unfortunately, no one had really seen that sleep medicine needed to be on the docket. So he had tremendous visionary skill in seeing that there were millions of people that could be helped. And in from 1970, he had to put together a laboratory, a sleep laboratory, because he didn't know what sleep disorders existed. If you've read his book, you read all about this. It's called The Promise of Sleep. And he had to do the discovery. So he was in the process. He knew about narcolepsy, where people basically get excited and have what's called cataplexy, where they fall to the ground. And what he did was he did a lot of research with dogs at Stanford and had several dogs, and he can tell you stories about his show with 60 Minutes and the dogs. But the thing that really fascinated me was that in 1972, he took a group of researchers that were from throughout the world, from France, from Italy, from different parts of the world, that were kind of tapping, they were doing aspects of sleep medicine, but nobody had put it together. He brought them all to Stanford, and between 1970 and 1972, they ran out of money doing research. They were researching, and they ran out of money. So in 1972, they said, one of the doctors said, well, we needed to start seeing patients with all that we've learned all that we've learned during the past 2 years. So they knew about narcolepsy, and they knew that there was a doctor in France who had studied. It wasn't even called sleep apnea. It was just called disordered breathing. And people were getting tracheostomies to treat sleep apnea. So what occurred was this doctor had come to Stanford, and together they began to see develop codes for billing, billing insurance company, receiving reimbursements, and that's the way it started. Technology was very kind of like he had an EEG from the neurology department, so he brought that over. He had a Holter monitor, so he saw that if we put EKG leads on patients, we could measure their heart rate and see if they're having arrhythmias. Oximetry, measuring the oxygen in the blood, didn't even exist until 1972. Sometime in the early 70s. So he never thought in his right mind that we would be here today 37 years later, and that way of testing, that way of treating human beings would be the what we would end up with. He thought technology would advance, and he didn't think about home testing, but he just knew that what I'm doing now is discovery, and clinical sleep medicine will evolve over time. The difficulty is the almighty dollar. There's money to be made in sleep medicine, and there was a lot of money. I was driving up here with Bill, and I told him, do you know how much has been spent on diagnosis last year on sleep disorders? $2.5 billion. Do you know how much was spent on treatment? $600 million. And he was... He was pretty shocked to hear that. But those numbers should be reversed. So anyway, it's been a long road. All living organisms must sleep. We've known that since the beginning of mankind, that all living organisms must sleep. So sleep medicine has only been around for less than 50 years. So it was, even though, animals sleep and dream, we sleep and dream, the multitude of other organisms go through this process. He knew sleep and dreams sleep was extremely important, and he went on to come up with this quote, which back I'm not exactly sure when he said it. Maybe he can tell you, but. The big thing here is that the discovery of diagnosis and treatment of sleep disorders, and what he really wanted to do was to give all of you, patients, the basic knowledge of sleep so that if you wanted to change some aspect of your sleep, that you could do that. And so it was a selfless activity of creating this field of sleep medicine. So the next slide is he also, at the same time, if this wasn't enough, in 1970, he started what's become the most popular undergraduate course at Stanford University called Sleep and Dreams. And he told me on the way up that he's teaching one-third of it now. The two-thirds are being taught by a doctor who's in traffic who will be here in 15 minutes or so, but his partner. And so this is a picture of the TAs and the staff that put on the course. It's a lot of work. And so... this is an example of him teaching, and what he's teaching is the difference between wakefulness, drowsiness, and the onset of sleep. And he takes the class through the process and says that the onset of sleep is instantaneous. They did an experiment back in the day, from 70 to 72, where they had a strobe light on this patient, and this strobe light would the patient would press a a button whenever the strobe light went on. So the strobe light goes on and off and on and off, and the patient's pressing the button, and they're there, and it's midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, he's pressing the button, and then all of a sudden, he looks, the strobe light flashes, no button is pushed, and they're recording the EEG at that time during this experiment. And what they noticed when they went back and looked at the EEG was the moment from consciousness to sleep or unconsciousness was instantaneous. So he came up with a saying for this, and he calls it drowsiness is red alert. And drowsiness is red alert is something that everyone at Stanford undergraduates have heard. And it's really, really important because a high percentage of long-haul truck drivers that are on the roads have sleep apnea. And accidents like this occur because they fall asleep at the wheel. And they cause an excessive amount of damage to human life and to property and so forth. And he said it doesn't have to be this way. There are two aspects. It's not just sleep disorders. The other is a discipline called fatigue management. And in 1970, we brought two long-haul trucking companies from, not 1970. I was 7 years old at that time, so it wasn't 1970. The year was 2000. We brought truck drivers from two Midwest small long-haul trucking companies, million-mile drivers, and Dr. Dement put them through a two-week program to teach them about fatigue management, to teach them about sleep deprivation. So somebody can be extremely getting one of those accidents due to a sleep disorder like sleep apnea, but they could also get into the same accident due to sleep deprivation. If they don't sleep, then it develops into what he termed sleep debt. And sleep debt grows larger and larger the more hours that you don't sleep. So anyway, so that became quite – drowsiness is red alert was a big aspect. All right. So what is obstructive sleep apnea? It's a cessation of breathing that lasts for 10 seconds. And it's this right here. This is called a hypopnea, and this is normal breathing. So just think about it. Somebody stops breathing from 10 seconds to a minute over 600 times a night. And let's say they have to sleep more than 8 hours. They sleep 10 hours. This is very common with these sorts of patients. 600 divided by 10 is 60 times an hour. So their apnea hypopnea index, or it could be their respiratory disturbance index, is 60 events per hour. That means once a minute, they stop breathing for 10 seconds. And they go from it doesn't cause them to physically arouse, but it does cause them to for the time it does cause a subconscious arousal, and so this occurs. And they go back to sleep. And then a minute later, it happens again. So they wake up the next morning more tired than they were when they went to bed. And I'm amazed that these people can function and continue living as long as they do, given the havoc that they're bringing to the human body. So, see how I'm doing. I put my finger on it. 20 minutes, okay. So, prevalence of sleep disorders. There, the correlation of sleep disorders with sleep apnea is tremendous. 77% of obese patients have it. 72% of diabetics have sleep apnea. 57% of people with cardiovascular disease have sleep apnea. So with the prevalence as big as it is, as large as it is, I began to think about this disorder and think about the fact that what comes first, the chicken or the egg? And what I began to say and teach my people at SleepQuest is that sleep apnea is causal. It's more than a contributing factor. It's causal. If you occlude the upper airway and have someone's oxygen level go down to 75%, well, then the heart muscle has to do bicep curls all night long to reoxygenate the system. We're a closed system. We don't have blood flying everywhere. So the heart has to work that much harder. That's the beginning of congestive heart failure. That's the beginning of hypertension. So I saw it as causal. And the big thing here is that there are four major cost drivers that lead to 18% of GDP, 18% of gross domestic product in the United States is spent on healthcare. And those three are diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. The fourth, guess what it is? Anybody?
Cancer.
Cancer. You got it. It's cancer. And have they shown that there's a correlation between cancer and sleep apnea? Yes, they have. Recently, in the last few years, they've discovered that there's a correlation between cancer and, but three of the four. So the indirect costs of sleep apnea, it costs $3 for every $1 that is spent in healthcare on disease. For an undiagnosed patient to go through the healthcare system, it costs $3 for every $1. It's three times more expensive. So we have a debt of $30 billion that are correlated to these different disorders. And it's driving the country to lose a lot of money. And so I think that if people took sleep apnea more seriously, doctors began to, primary care doctors especially, began to ask questions about people's sleep. Sleep is an unconscious activity, I mentioned. And so what happens is the only time the primary care doctor gets involved with sleep apnea is when the wife comes in and says, my life is really lousy. I'm sleeping in the basement because my husband snores so bad and stops breathing. I'm worried that he's going to die every night. So I'm just, and some of you are laughing because you've experienced it or you know what I'm talking about. And that's not the reason. They should be asking each patient, are you fatigued during the day? Do you snore? Do you wake up in the morning with headaches? Do you look at their chart? Do they have hypertension? But they're not doing it. So Moving on. Apnea increases cost. So, this is my own father in 1994. And he loved to go to great restaurants for dinner, like the one next door, Donatello. It's a fabulous Italian restaurant. I'm married to an Italian. And I also have taken after my father, and I love great restaurants. But he handed me a Polaroid while we were eating dinner one night and said, Robert, last night I went through this sleep study at Stanford in the sleep lab, and they handed me this Polaroid picture in the morning. And here you go. I don't want it. You keep it. Because this should be the inspiration for changing the patient experience when it comes to sleep. Because he knew that I was selling cardiovascular and diabetic products to primary care physicians. Everything happens for a reason. And what was happening at that time at Stanford, it was 1994, they were doing a validation on a portable monitor called the MaySAM. And Dr. Dement took it upon himself to say, wow, what if I gave these to primary care physicians and had them begin to screen and diagnose patients with sleep-disordered breathing? And that's exactly what he did. Well, these dozen or so doctors that got these MaySAMs were friends of mine or doctors that I worked with, because I was in sales and marketing and I was calling on doctors in Fresno and in all over the place. And they would tell me, Robert, sleep is going to be the big disease state of the 21st century. If you want to do well, go and start researching this industry because there's a lot here. And I didn't know what they were talking about, but I figured that I should take them up on it. So I went to the Stanford Medical Library, and I researched and found that there were two devices only. Now there are about 45, two devices for portable sleep testing in the world. I got the distribution rights to sell this MaySAM product in the United States to primary care physicians. Because the manufacturers were laughing at me. They had sales reps that were calling on sleep labs and calling on home care companies, but nobody was calling on the physician. Nobody was calling on the primary care physician. So they gladly signed an agreement with me. I was buying the devices for $4,000 and selling them for $12,500. And I was selling them. But the problem was that I had to be on the airplane all the time. I set up independent reps throughout the country to resell this product, and they couldn't close the sale. So I had to jump on a plane and fly to New York and go in and meet with the doctor and answer all the objections. Why don't I just keep sending it to the sleep lab? And that was the birth of SleepQuest. That was the birth. So for the next 2 years, I was a reseller of this product. And in 1996, I saw the fragmentation in the sleep industry. I saw the fact that home care companies were doing a dreadful job of getting patients well. And I got into healthcare because I wanted to help people. And I said, this is wrong. So I took a blank piece of paper and I said, if I'm the patient, how am I going to design it? And so I came up with a seamless approach to diagnosis and treatment for this disease.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Traditional sleep laboratory model. Here's the primary care physician. They say, well, what are they going to do? They go ahead and send the patient to an hour-long consultation with the sleep doctor. And the sleep doctor sees them and recommends that they go and have a sleep study at the center that they're affiliated with. So the patient then goes to the sleep center. And like my father, they go on and the sleep doctors, the most prevalent sleep disorder is insomnia. But the way it's treated is with behavioral therapy for pure insomnia, not if it's with another disorder. So, but they schedule them for an attended study to do a polysomnogram in the hospital or in the laboratory. What I discovered was that only 15% of the time do patients have neurologic disorders or severe comorbidities where they really needed to be seen, attended during the night and checked on every 2 hours. And these patients were very sick, and that was the correct environment for them. Or they were 1 in 2,000 patients that have narcolepsy, or one patient that has a rare REM sleep behavior disorder, or a parasomnia. But these disorders are relatively rare. And 85% of the time, these patients can be diagnosed and treated in the home through a pathway that is one-third the cost and, with SleepQuest, a much better outcome. So what is happening right now is that after that study, the doctor used to send the patient to the home care company. And a home care company carries 1,500 different products for 150 disease states. And their business is to provide devices, not to provide sleep care. So what we do is provide sleep care. And what these sleep laboratories, the best ones in the country, refer to SleepQuest. And five or so of those sleep physicians are in the audience tonight. And I want to thank them for being here and thank them for being coming and listening, and most of all, thank them for the referrals. We just greatly appreciate them. There's reasons as to why we're getting the referrals from sleep labs, and I'll talk about those in a bit. But these, I'm putting down, these are the different, 80% of the time, the gold standard or the most common form of sleep treatment for sleep apnea is CPAP. 20% of the time, patients have more mild disorders, mild sleep apnea, and can use an oral appliance or have surgery, perhaps, or use another type of treatment. And so the compliance level, the outcome with these home care companies is less than 50%. We've been able to show that we're able to get 91% of our patients to use the device long term, because now the devices, and I brought one to show you, to kind of show you that it's just came out on the market this week. And that's the size of a CPAP now. And so they've shrunk down to, they're very quiet now, and they're much more patient-friendly than they were 20 years ago. So this is the sleep lab approach using SleepQuest instead of the home care company. And now the devices, they have a modem in it, so the device talks with the server all night long and sends the compliance data. So we're able to see the data and see whether or not the patient is having a problem. And then we follow up the next day and ensure that within 90 days, we get 91% compliant. So now let me share with you, that is what a patient looks like in the sleep disorder center. This is what they look like in the home. And what I found is that no one's ever studied, I'm not going to go down that track because it's the where I'm going with this is that in your own home, it's much more, in my opinion, it's much more representative of a night's sleep. And you're able to move. I've had patients with RDIs of 100 that have come to me and said, please do a home study because I couldn't move during the study at the lab. And I'm a side sleeper. I sleep in a lateral position. So we did the study, and they moved during the study, and their RDI was 20. So it cut it by 500%. Just by being able to move. So those are some of the things that I started to realize. Technology has really improved, and it's gotten to the point where people that are studying in the home, the devices measure the same parameters that are measured with 26 leads in the sleep lab. So I went through the sleep laboratory model. Now, to spend a little time on our integrated sleep care pathway for patients, starts with our primary care physician. And the primary care physician, we have to empower with information about sleep apnea. And so we do that. We explain much of the same things I'm explaining tonight and tell them that we're here to help. We're not here to obviate sleep labs. Sleep labs are needed. We just don't need 35 of them within 30 miles of us. The University of Marburg in Germany, 20 years ago, they had a socialized system, and they had 1 2-bed center for a population of 1 million people. We have 35 sleep centers within 30 miles of where we're sitting right now. It's really crazy. So just put it all up there and then, okay, so the primary care physician refers the patient to us. We do the diagnostic study. The patient sleeps in their own home. And then after the study, we then move on to sending a report that's interpreted by the same board-certified sleep physician that works in the the same sleep physician that works in the sleep laboratory. And so this process, so the next step is if I were a patient, I would go back to my primary care physician and they would say, well, how'd it go? And say, oh, it went pretty well. I was able to sleep in my normal home and it went okay. And so he looks at the results and says, well, I see that on the report it says that you have moderate to severe sleep apnea. You stop breathing 30 times an hour, which is once every 2 minutes, you're stopping to breathe for at least 10 seconds. And so that doctor then says the most effective therapy is continuous positive airway pressure. The only problem is that a lot of patients find it difficult to use. And I'm going to send you to the same company, SleepQuest, and they specialize in providing sleep care. All they do is see sleep apnea patients all day long. And so he writes a prescription, and now we get to the insurance company. The insurance company, not the doctor, decides that this patient needs to go on to an auto CPAP right away. So it doesn't allow them to try out the device. And so they send a prescription to SleepQuest. We do all the steps, and we provide the equipment to the patient. We work like crazy to get them well, to use the device long term. We've created our own mask algorithm where we ask patients basic questions like, are you claustrophobic? Do you have a deviated septum? Are you a mouth breather? These sorts of routine questions are not asked by the home care companies. And so what ends up happening is that with those answers to those questions that the patient gives us, that helps us determine which of four genres of masks will be most effective for the patient. That's how we've been able to achieve 91% compliance. That, and then we also, I tried to build this business with respiratory therapists. Well, they weren't... That didn't work out. I also tried to bring in polysomnography technologists that worked in the sleep lab. But I learned early on that I had to create my own professional. So we have what are called sleep care specialists that provide the care for the patients. And so this... So if the patient, for some reason, ends up not being compliant with CPAP, then what we do, our protocol, is to send the patient back to the sleep physician in that community, send that patient back to the sleep lab or the sleep center, sleep clinic, and have them have a consultation by that doctor. Because there may be sleep deprivation, maybe part of the reason that they're not sleeping. They could have another disorder where they really need more help. Because if we can't get them well, I can say nobody's going to get them well. Because our protocols are not done by anybody else. So now I'm going to stop talking for a couple minutes and let Dr. Dement tell you about his experience 13 years ago. We've worked together for close to 20 years. And what brought us together is the improving access for patients, creating a continuum of care, focusing on the outcome, decreasing the cost. So let's listen to him. I'm sorry. PowerPoint.
Sitting right here, why don't we listen? There it is. I understand you are the chief scientific advisor for a company called SleepQuest.
That's correct.
And I would assume that they are helping come up with some solutions.
Well, I think one of the thrusts of the company is that the access to patients is much more convenient and easy, and there's a dedication to a continuum of care, And I think right now we feel more than 95% of all the victims of sleep disorders are, you know, they are sick and they don't know why. So the whole thrust is awareness of society, awareness of physicians, making the diagnosis and treatment of sleep disorders easier, more accessible, and above all, following the patients closely. And these routines and approaches are not well integrated into medical practice at the present time. So we need all sorts of novel approaches to help the millions and millions of people who are in desperate need.
More education.
More education.
For the public and the doctors as well.
And the doctors as well.
Doctor, thank you very much. Very interesting indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, very well done. Not well integrated into medical practice at the present time. We've gone from, he said, 95% of patients with sleep disorders don't know why. They've got a disorder and they don't know. Well, in 13 years, we've made some progress. We're up to 80% of patients with sleep apnea are still undiagnosed. And what Dr. Dement thought, and the reason he gave those devices to the primary care physicians, was that we need to increase access, give more patients the opportunity to get this type of testing and treatment, and that we can't keep it contained with the small group of sleep physicians. We'll never solve this problem. We'll never unravel. Yeah, we'll get to questions in a second. Sorry. Thanks. So that was the... So I'm getting near the end here, and the important aspect is that we've created a complementary integrated sleep care program with the sleep laboratory. So what you see on this last slide is that both models are up there, and they can work together, and they have worked together. And a majority of our revenue right now comes from the sleep laboratory's referrals. That's why I am so appreciative of them referring patients to us. Now, I think my model is tremendously idealistic, tremendously altruistic, and it may be a little bit naive about the changes that can occur in healthcare. But this little David that is dealing with all of the healthcare organizations and the insurance company, what I'd like to say is that the Goliaths that are out there, that they, what we're all about is doing the same thing as the biblical story. Everybody knows how it ended. And what we're about is to take care of every patient well and get them to use their device and be compliant with therapy. Thank you. So you had a question?
Thank you. Here's a microphone.
Thank you. My name is Shelley, and my first husband, not my current one. Where is he? Did he leave? Attention deficit. My first husband was a doctor here in San Francisco many, many years ago. And I recall he told me, Dr. Dement, that nutrition was a two-hour requirement when he attended medical school. And thinking about everything that you all are discussing today, I'm thinking that there are a lot of parallels between that level of education that he received in, whatever, 1972 and the current status of the understanding of sleep medicine. So really, I'm trying to make an open-ended question here. What is the current status of sleep medicine in medical schools in the United States? I read your book, by the way, when you wrote it. Whatever, 700 pages? Something like that. Put me to sleep. And I was very, very impressed for many reasons. Family has sleep problems. My entire family has sleep problems. And so I read it on that level and then, you know, married a guy who has sleep apnea. So full circle, you know, just fascinating. Basic question, what level? I mean, is it just minuscule that the medical schools are approaching this issue?
If I could answer that, we've conducted several studies of medical school education, but not recently, I'm sorry to say. And there's essentially no teaching about sleep disorders. And I'd say that 15 years ago, maybe. And I don't think, with all the tremendous competition for curriculum time, no matter how important you think the subject is, it's tough to get curriculum time in medical school now. Medical schools are still 4 years, you know, whereas knowledge is, God knows, 100 times greater. So I think that this question of sleep apnea, however, the prevalence is so high. One in every 4 males, 1 in every 9 females. The seriousness is, I think, very, very serious if left undiagnosed and treated. There ought to be some kind of push. And maybe the American Academy of Sleep Medicine will eventually accomplish this for medical school teaching. I think sleep centers, which are situated in medical schools, have to some extent taken on that responsibility. Certainly we have at Stanford. But I can't resist when we first opened the Sleep Disorder Center at Stanford University in 1970, and we sort of didn't know what to do. All we knew is there were a lot of people complaining about their sleep. I had been interested in narcolepsy, and so we advertised for people who were excessively sleepy, not knowing what was going to happen. And, of course, the majority of people who are excessively sleepy and have a sleep disorder have obstructive sleep apnea. So the problem was, at that time, the only treatment was a hole in the throat. Theoretically you open it to breathe at night and close it and function more or less normally in the daytime. And the big problem was several patients refused treatment who we felt were seriously ill, and two of them died at the age of 40, died suddenly in their sleep. You know, and it was the usual, the heart attack. But they had this severe obstructive sleep apnea. And I think there's plenty of evidence now that it evolves, it's very serious in its evolution for cardiovascular disease and accidents. I think we did a study of truck drivers, and I say I still am sort of hyper alert when a truck approaches me, because 75% of the drivers had obstructive sleep apnea. Now you'd say, was it because they were overweight? Well, no. And I still can't explain that, but at least the trucking companies feeling that they have sort of awakened to this problem, although it was very difficult in the beginning. So it's a terribly serious problem, and it really should be highlighted in medical school. I mean, I guess that's one of my life's failures, really, if I had to catalog failures. But I sure tried.
So I have a question. What are the symptoms of sleep apnea? I mean, how would you know that you might have sleep apnea and should be tested for it, and how would that be distinguished from other sleep problems?
Well, the first thing I always ask is, do you snore? You know,
if you can, honestly, it's, well, step one back. We actually did a population survey of snoring many years ago, and it was kind of astounding that 22% of people didn't know whether or not they snored, so I assume they slept alone. Because certainly if you don't sleep alone, your bed partner knows it and hates it. So if snoring would be the first risk factor, then do you get tired in the daytime would be the second one. If you have a spouse, does that spouse think that you stop breathing? And it's I would say the diagnosis is about the easiest thing there is. A treatment is much more of a challenge in getting people to remain compliant over a long period of time and to know that they're compliant enough to relieve the illness and what's associated with the illness.
My question kind of tag teams on that. In fact, many of us may love the results of our CPAP, but I don't think are enamored of the actual CPAP wearing. And so I'm wondering what's coming down the pike in terms of treatment and or updates and or research to actually be curative versus...
There's someone in the back of the room who can answer that question very well, but there's also a surgical approach, I might say, but that's not what you're interested in.
Well, you should love your CPAP. You should be, because it's never gotten better. So it's a lot better than I've been in Robert showed a smaller version of it. But also, now there are pacemakers for sleep apnea, so it's implantable devices you can use. So there's different surgical approaches that are there for it. For milder cases, there are ways of splinting the nose open. There's a range of things you can do. Positional devices are out there. So you don't have to just use CPAP. But CPAP's never been better than it's been now. So if you've tried CPAP in the past and say it didn't work, try it again because it's really gotten better. They're better masks. There's CPAP specifically now designed for women and CPAP masks specifically designed for women also. Stomach sleepers, you can turn – you know, nobody really sleeps face down for real. You're face down but your head is turned. So there are masks specifically that let you sleep with your head turned that way too. You can do that too. But I think the future is going to be in surgical options.
How about oral appliances?
My strong feeling, I see what Dr. Kenningsbury says or Dr. Palio, but one thing is to be absolutely sure they work, and otherwise. Appliances have been effective in certain cases, but that would certainly not be the first choice.
I went to a lecture by CG. His name is Christian Guinimo. He actually coined the term obstructive sleep apnea syndrome, and he was very negative about oral appliances. And what he told me, or what he told the audience, was that what he has noticed that the 5-year outcomes for patients that go on oral appliances were not good. And what I noticed when I tried one of them was that my teeth started to move. And that seems to be one of the problems with oral appliances.
I would disagree.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you disagree because there are lots of people that have benefited greatly from oral appliances. So I'm just telling you what Christian Guinimo told me and what I learned in that lecture and my own experience. But I'm happy, whatever works. If it works for you, that's great. I'm sure Raphael has. This is Dr. Palio from Stanford. He's on KCBS Radio, I think. No, KGO Radio, quite often. And anyway, we're lucky to have him as well. So go ahead and answer the question.
Just for the previous question, as far as the future, the real future is the prevention of sleep apnea. And that's what we've not really discussed. Talk about treatment, but we know that adults with sleep apnea were children with sleep apnea for the most part. So now the idea is to identify sleep apnea in their children quickly and use orthodontics and now they're using myofunctional therapy, tongue exercises, so that we can prevent what sets them up. The sleep apnea makes people gain weight, but we see these little kids have had sleep apnea for years, and it's misidentified as attention deficit disorder. And what we really want to do is all these adults with sleep apnea pick up on their children and prevent them from showing up in them. So that's the real future, is it? As far as oral appliances, there are an approved treatment for sleep apnea. And definitely mild to moderate sleep apnea patients will do well with them. So they're just one more tool that we have. And it's not one or the other. You can definitely use CPAP when you're in the home and when you travel, use an oral appliance. Or many, many patients use oral appliances as their main treatment. So it's available. It's covered by insurance. Medicare pays for oral appliances, so they're validated treatments. But you should have them custom made to your bite. The oral appliances that sometimes just boil and bite, they can actually shift teeth, so you get them custom made. And more importantly, after you've had been fitted with an oral appliance, you should get a repeat sleep study at some point and see the dentist also at least once a year to make sure the integrity of the device is there and hasn't messed up your teeth. But they're just one more tool.
Thanks. So how often should you have a CPAP machine recalibrated? Is it something that changes over time, or is it pretty stable once you've had it calibrated correctly?
I have poor hearing, but the question
is, do you recalibrate CPAP machines? And that's a whole continuity of care issue.
Yeah. Well, now with auto CPAP, the benefit of that is, well, a couple of things. First of all, no, there's not a lot that, I mean, they usually, their life expectancy is about 5 years. And after that time, they tend to, well, some people have had devices that have lasted 10 years or longer, but, auto CPAP, I'm a big believer in because it allows, patients, their body habitus, the way their body changes. Let's say they lose a bunch of weight. Well, then they don't require as much pressure. And instead of having another titration in the lab or having having us do a titration, instead of doing that, the device will automatically respond to the disordered breathing and lower the pressures as long as it's set within the right range. So the important thing is to make sure that the device is in the right range. And usually there's about a 6 centimeter difference. The problem with giving patients auto CPAP, just the insurance companies now want to save money, so they just give patients auto CPAP, is that they get the device and the provider really doesn't know, the doctor doesn't know what pressure the patient needs. So he has to set the device from 4 centimeters of water to 20 centimeters of water. And what happens a lot, what we see a lot, is the 4 centimeters, I mean, it's as good. These machines have microprocessors to adjust the pressure. Well, they take time to increase pressure. So many times it's not efficacious at the lower pressures. And sometimes what happens is a leak starts to develop in the mask. And then all of a sudden, the machine doesn't know any different. What does it do? The motor in it speeds up, and pretty soon the mask is being blown off your face. And it's like sticking your head out the window and driving 80 miles an hour instead of 30 miles an hour. So.
To answer the question, no, they don't usually need to be recalibrated very often. They're usually pretty stable.
Yeah.
Yes, you were mentioning earlier about the evolution of sleep apnea. I had a question because I'm 33, just recently diagnosed with sleep apnea. I'm skinny. I don't visually think that I have the physical profile of someone with sleep apnea. You know, maybe that's just my misperception, but how young are people having sleep apnea now? Like, when is there a median age that people get sleep apnea or should be actually, you know, looked at?
Well, Raphael is now mostly in charge of teaching sleep and dreams, so that's the type of question that I think he should answer.
Generally have sleep apnea. It's little kids. 3 to 6 is a perfect age to check for sleep apnea. You can even see it younger, right? Any mouth breathing, any night sweats, any snoring, but from age 3 on, a lot of sleep apnea. In fact, if your child snores before the age of 4, quadruples the risk of being labeled with ADD when they hit elementary school.
Wow. Any more questions?
Can we discuss a little bit more about the surgical aspects?
Yeah. I wouldn't like to partake in that discussion because, like the oral appliance, the surgery, as far as my experience in reading clinical validations, is even worse. So perhaps Dr. Play or Dr. Dement can... I mean, there is a type of surgery that is, if you're willing to do it and have craniofacial adjustments where they break the jaw and have to wire it back shut again, and then there's multiple stages of the process. There's and so it's multiple steps. And so you... I think Dr. Palaio or Dr. Palaio would be better to speak to that question.
Well, there's about as many different approaches as there are surgeons who do it, but we've worked with surgeons at Stanford who had a very successful record, and I was admired most the tongue advancement approach. This is to act, the tongue is attached to a very tiny area of the jaw, and you can actually pull it out, and that enlarges the airway. And so I think that I thought that was – I guess they're still having great results with that. But the few papers I've read are, you know, really
– Now, Dr. Dement's correct. There's excellent surgical options available that are now more readily available. There's better insurance coverage for these options now. Yeah. So – CPAP is still considered the mainline treatment for most patients, but definitely we consider surgery in most patients as an option, especially our younger patients or single patients. Why not consider surgery, right? You're not going to get a 21-year-old to take their CPAP out on dates usually, so surgery is definitely an option for them.
I have to say one thing. There was a study of the spouse of sleep apnea victims, and they had a significantly higher incident of auto accidents. In other words, they were drowsy driving because he's been awakened so many times at night by that awful noise. And I think for people who say, well, what's it going to cost? But I say, if you're a married person, it's two for the price of one. It really is.
Yeah.
And in the early days when we used to see really bad patients, the wives were almost... or the spouses, it was sometimes the husband, were almost as bad off in terms of sleepiness and impairment as the victim of sleep apnea.
So your question about being 33 and having sleep apnea, well, from what I've learned, sleep apnea is caused by two things. It's not just redundant tissue. It doesn't just happen to obese patients. I have sleep apnea because I have anatomically a very, very narrow airway. So it's the size of your airway that is, it's like a garden hose. If it's nice and wide, it can a lot of water. If same thing in the airway. If you have a small airway, it takes more force of pressure to keep it open. The other thing is we're constantly innovating. And the one slide I left out, or the one thing I left out, is that we're moving into telehealth now. And what I mean by that is we don't need to be face-to-face to get patients well with CPAP. With the mask algorithm and with our expertise, we're able to work with patients to get them to use the device long-term. Our compliance, we're taking care of patients in Japan from California and getting them the same 91% compliance. So we've done that with over 500 of those patients. So there's a lot more options now than there ever was. And to be a little bit more positive, things have really improved on the technology side. So, Thanks.
All right. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We thank Robert Koenigsberg, SleepQuest CEO, and Dr. William C. Dement for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.